beans, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Hunter Killer, Johnny English Strikes Again, Mid-90s, Free Solo, and a look back at The Fog. I'll also be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring Creepshow and Maximum Overdrive. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
First piece of news is a rest in peace to James Caron, who died this week at the age of 94. Now, a lot of people don't recognize the name immediately, but you would probably recognize the face and possibly the voice if you watched movies through the 80s and into the 90s. James Caron was a character actor. He's best known for some notable horror movie appearances. He was the boss in Poltergeist, the guy who moves the tombstones, but not the graves. He was also in Return of the Living Dead, Part 1 and 2, essentially playing the same character for some strange reason. They, even though those movies aren't directly connected, he's in there as a guy who basically becomes a zombie. And he was also in the film Invaders from Mars, not the original, but the Tobe Hooper remake back in the 80s. He was just a character actor that showed up in a lot of genre films that I remember as a kid. And, you know, he's sort of this indelible actor and presence on screen that was never the big starring role, but always was kind of fun, especially in like Return of the Living Dead. He's one of the more entertaining things about that movie. And it's sad to see him go. Yeah, he was 94. That's a good run, but it's always sad to see you go. The next piece of news I want to talk about really quickly is apparently there's rumors that Warner Brothers is looking to get rid of Ben Affleck and Henry Cavill. They're done with them as Superman and Batman. The whole Batman-Ben Affleck thing has been percolating for a while, and then he's like, he's going to do another Batman movie, then he's not, and they're deciding what to do. And I think Henry Cavill, the same thing. They're trying to figure out what to do with him because the DC Cinematic Universe is in shambles. Because you had such great hits like Wonder Woman, and they're hoping to God that Aquaman does well this Christmas, but we don't know. And everything was such a stumble because I think they were too beholden to a certain style and look that didn't quite fit for an entire universe of characters that fit for Batman when they did Man of Steel. And that kind of marginally worked for Man of Steel, but not really. But they had that Batman glowering, depressing look that Nolan brought in with the Batman Begins and the Dark Knight movies. But it just doesn't translate to making an entire comic book series based on that. And they've had such success with television. I think they're ready to reboot this thing again. I just hope that they do it with a little more ease and comfort. I think you can back end and retcon Wonder Woman and Aquaman into this thing because they do it in the comics all the time. The next piece of news is another redevelopment news is that it's actually two of them. One of them is they're looking to do a reboot of the Pirates of the Caribbean series, which I kind of am like, but it's been going on. It's, you know, since 2003, there's been a steady flow of these movies, and they may have waited 5 years between a couple of them, but they've done what, like 5 or 6 of them? And they're looking to reboot it. I don't know whether they're going to have Johnny Depp in it. Now that's the big crux of it. They're looking to get the Deadpool writers for this. But that's not what's going to give the jingle in the jeans for this series. It's Johnny Depp. Johnny Depp is the international star that runs this series. And while Johnny Depp can't carry any other franchise outside of the Pirates of the Caribbean movies, he has a huge fan base, both domestically. Like, my cousin's a huge fan of the Jack Sparrow character. But without Johnny Depp, you don't have Pirates of the Caribbean. I don't think you can just spin it off of Orlando Bloom or anything like that. Or these kids that nobody cared about who are in the most recent one. The last piece of development news comes from the sports world is that apparently LeBron James, Ohio's own LeBron James, who's not in Ohio anymore, is looking to move into film production. He's, you know, I was reading somewhere he's coming to the end of his professional career. He's like 33. Yeah, I think he's done enough now. I think he still has some years to play basketball left, but he's looking to get into movies. He had a small part in Trainwreck, and of course he's working on the new Space Jam movie, but he's looking to reboot Friday the 13th, which I think is kind of cool. I support anybody trying to reboot a franchise who's clearly doing it because they love it. And then sometimes you get somebody like Rob Zombie doing the Halloween movies, and he's terrible at those. But I'd watch a LeBron James produced Friday the 13th reboot. I hope that he just uses the Blumhouse model. The big problem with these movies, like when they tried to reboot Friday the 13th, and now they're doing it with Halloween, is you get this massive success with the movie, and then you spend $25 million on a slasher movie, and that's not what you should be making. You should be making a slasher movie for $1 or $2 million. If it makes 20 or 30, you've made a profit. You don't need $90 million opening weekends. You will never be able to sustain that with horror movies. It just won't happen. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to look at is called The Long Dumb Road. It's flying under the radar, and it's going to be released on November 16th.
So what's your story?
I'm driving to LA. I'm going to start art school.
This is America at its purest, dude.
You party?
Yeah.
Cool. You want a road brew?
No, well, I'm driving. But you're more than welcome to do it. All right. You know, keep it low, just in case there's any cops or anything.
Don't worry about it, dude. I'm pretty much a professional level at drinking and driving.
I think the universe brought us together for a reason, you know?
I've had, like, a pretty sheltered life.
What's your outlook on the world? What do you got to say?
I don't know.
This is essentially a raunchy comedy road film, and it has some actors I really enjoy in it. Jason Mantzoukas plays the sort of the unhinged character in this, which is what he always plays. You almost never see Jason Mantzoukas playing the reputable doctor. He's always the doctor. If he's ever playing a doctor, he's usually selling pain meds outside his back office. So Jason Mantzoukas has kind of made a little bit of a cottage industry for himself, playing the unhinged, crazy type. You know, he's Rafi from The League, and Rafi was one of my favorite characters. Even though he was psychotic, it made him very, very funny and very entertaining, and it looks like he's going to be like that in this one. It also has the kid from the Grand Budapest Hotel as his sort of like his straight man sidekick. But this looks like it could be funny. It's very sort of a grassroots independent looking, it's got some roots in there. So I imagine that this is going to be something that's going to be playing in limited release, but hey, it looks pretty funny. Jason Mantzoukas always makes me laugh. The next one I want to talk about is Cold Pursuit, which opens on February 8th, starring Liam Neeson as a vengeful snowplow driver.
Kyle's dead. Tell me what happened.
He got mixed up with some drug dealer. Viking. He likes hurting people.
What is it with all these nicknames? Speedo, Viking, Eskimo.
It's a gangster thing.
Did you have a nickname?
Wingman.
Gonna kill him. No, those guys.
One guy can disappear. Two? Who wants me dead?
Three of Viking's drug dealers have disappeared.
What makes you think you can kill a man?
I read it in a crime novel.
This is sort of like all the jokes coming out of basically saying this is Taken on Ice. And it does kind of look like that. It's a very standard Liam Neeson movie where a guy has been wronged, somebody in his family has been killed, he needs to avenge a loved one, and he goes after him. He just happens to be a snowplow driver in this movie. I don't know why that sounds so absurd, mainly because snowplow driver seems like it would be the most relatively mundane job. I mean, you'd be plowing the same stretch of road and you're doing the same thing. It almost seems like a stretch, but apparently this is actually based on a foreign film that has a certain amount of notoriety. But I think, of course, Liam Neeson has that special set of skills that I think is going to do him well in this movie. So this looks like it's going to be run-of-the-mill Liam Neeson. It's coming out in early February, which is when most of his movies come out, usually January or February. Those are when these revenge action movies tend to do well. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Hunter Killer, Johnny English Strikes Again, and Free Solo.
One hail to the pumpkin song.
We'll be right back.
welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump right into the movie reviews. Well, at least I'd like to jump right into the movie reviews. There's been a couple snafus out there. And actually, I think snafu is the right term. If you know what snafu means, I'll give you the clean version. Situation normal, all fouled up. The situation's very normal. This happens all the time. Usually, I let this stuff roll off my back. I live in Columbus, Ohio. I live in the heartland, flyover country. I am not in one of the biggest markets out there. I'm not in New York or LA or Chicago. I'm not even in Cleveland. Cleveland gets more screenings than I do. And it is not uncommon for studios to not screen everything in my market. And it'll sometimes be huge movies. Like I remember the first Jurassic World, they didn't screen in Columbus. I had to go to Cincinnati to see it. For big movies like that, I will sometimes do that, but it always irks me if they don't screen it in my local market. And we have a big university here. There's no reason to not screen things in Columbus. There's actually a reason why we rank lower, and it's sort of a stupid mathematical reason. But they'll sometimes not screen stuff, and I let that go. But sometimes there's movies that I ask about, and this is when it gets me upset, and why I then go on the radio and rail on this. With a movie like Hunter Killer, I couldn't find a screening for it. I asked the rep. I literally emailed the rep and I'm like, hey, are you screening this and Johnny English anywhere near Columbus? And he said, no, sorry, we're not. Well, then I found out that they did. Now, I understand if there's not the budget to screen something. I don't think they screened Johnny English anywhere here, but they did screen Hunter Killer. The fact that they had a screening was actually kind of hidden from the press. And that really says something to me. When you actually screen a movie, you're showing a movie early, but you refuse to let press in or even let them know about it, you are trying to hide something. There is something wrong with your movie if you're doing that. It just is too suspicious. This isn't some movie that didn't have the budget or didn't have the interest. It just was hidden from its audience. And it was hidden from the press and the critics. You're obviously worried about bad reviews. You're obviously worried about... And the thing is, in this day and age, the word gets out. People know when a movie's garbage. They get the sense. And the thing is, when they show movies at like Thursday night around the country, people know by Friday morning if it's garbage. So you're not hiding anything. So just screen the freaking movie and let the chips fall. And if you made a crappy movie, that's on you. Anyways, let's talk about Hunter Killer really quickly. A U.S. submarine commander must thwart a Russian plan to overthrow the world's governments from under the Arctic ice.
We've been ordered to cross waters that no American sub has ever crossed before.
We are witnessing the most aggressive military buildup in Russian history.
We've been keeping tabs on the Russian president
and his defense minister, Durov.
We're dealing with a single rogue minister.
What if we could free President Zakharin?
We rescue the Russian president.
You know, eyes and ears on the ground.
Captain, waiting your orders.
We're going in with four of our boys and get one Russian president.
This movie feels like it should have been made in the 80s, but they just forgot. Or it got made and they somehow didn't release it until now and just finished the special effects. It stars Gerard Butler, and Gerard Butler about 10 years ago had a really big career. You know, he was coming off of 300, and he was kind of a big star suddenly, but now he's not. And when his last movie was like Geostorm, and look, I love Gerard Butler. I think he's a hoot. I've interviewed the guy. He's kind of a fun guy, but he doesn't quite have the same power that he used to. This thing looks like it's going to suck, and the fact that they didn't screen it and hit it for press means to me it probably really sucks.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk really quickly about Johnny English Strikes Again. Bumbling spy Johnny English is brought out of retirement to stop a mastermind hacker.
We have a problem.
Good.
The identities of our serving agents have been exposed.
The country is in a state of complete chaos.
And the universe sends me you.
She's the key to this case.
I'm not sure I've ever met a man quite like you.
Let me clear up the uncertainty for you. You haven't.
Tell me the agent you've got in the field is making some progress.
Target acquired.
This is another one that wasn't screened. I don't know if they were screening it for the public, but hiding it desperately from the press. I think the reason that this one wasn't screened is because these movies tend to do pretty terribly in the U.S. The Johnny English movies, I think the first one made like $25 million, and the second one didn't even make $10 million. This one, I don't think they're expecting much. It was supposed to be a wide release, and the theater counts were dwindling down. It's like 500 now. I think they're just releasing it out of courtesy. These movies tend to do very well overseas. Across the pond, this has already made like $100 million. It's a British movie, and it's very dry. It's even drier than standard British stuff that Americans like. I'm curious to see it. I kind of like the Johnny English movies. I like Rowan Atkinson, and I like British humor. So hopefully I'll get a chance to see it. It's just not today. But now it has to get a preemptive suck.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk really quickly about the movie Mid-90s. I know I said I was going to talk about Free Solo in this segment, but I'm doing Mid-90s because I don't have a trailer for it. A 13-year-old skateboarder makes friends and gets into trouble while growing up in 1990s Los Angeles. Now, like I said, I don't have a trailer for this, and there's a reason for it. It's not that I couldn't find one. It's just that there's so many swear words in this trailer, it would sound like a conversation between R2-D2 and BB-8. It's a very foul-mouthed trailer, because it's about 13-year-old teenage and, you know, older kids who are just hanging out and being friends. And so it's just lots of F-bombs, lots of swear words, lots of inappropriate language. And this is directed by Jonah Hill and written by Jonah Hill. And of course, he's best known for being an actor, but, you know, this is him stretching his directorial legs and trying to do something different. And I applaud that. Anytime somebody tries something different, I applaud that. They make movies like this periodically, every couple of years, you know, all the way going back to like movies like Kids, or if you remember Spring Breakers, Harmony Korine even shows up in this movie, where it's like the kids are acting inappropriate, they're saying inappropriate things, they're doing inappropriate things, they're doing stuff that's going to trigger some people into being like, oh, that's inappropriate and that's dangerous or whatever. And the response by the filmmakers is, well, that's what some people do. Whether you're taking drugs, whether you're having sex, whether you're swearing, whether you're using this sort of language. The language that is used, even the swearing, is a type of swearing that even politically incorrect now, it was very common back in the 90s. Overall, this movie, I respect what it's doing. I respect what it's trying to do, but it is just these kids flopping around. It almost feels like a documentary. And while it's somewhat autobiographical, it seems to be, to probably Jonah Hill's life, it also sort of seems like it's a bit of a teenage fantasy. There are things that happen to this 13-year-old kid that you're like, yeah, no, really, that wouldn't happen. Or if it did happen, it didn't happen in that context, which did give me a couple eye rolls. Overall, it's not my kind of movie. It feels a little bit like a Kevin Smith approach to a movie where it's like, well, everybody did this. And it's like, no, not really. Just a small segment of your generation did this. It's just all the people you knew did this. So it appeared everybody did all this stuff. But while this was popular in the 90s, it's not what everybody did. I think calling it mid-90s is a little bit grand, trying to capture an entire segment of a decade rather than just this very sort of narrow countercultural teenage experience, which is really all it is. And if you like that sort of thing and it's going to connect with you, you're going to love it. Otherwise, it's going to be a chore to watch. So it just depends on where your background is. I'm going to give it a kind of rocks just because I respect what they were doing.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Free Solo and The Fog. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews. First one is Free Solo. An ambitious mountain climber plans his greatest feat yet, to scale El Capitan without the aid of ropes or safety gear.
Does it feel different to be up there without a rope?
It's obviously like much higher consequence.
People who know a little bit about climbing, they're like, oh, he's totally safe. And then people who really know exactly what he's doing are freaked out.
I've thought about El Cap like for years, and every year I'm like, that's really scary. I'll never be content unless I at least put in the effort.
El Cap is the most impressive wall on Earth.
It's 3,200 feet of sheer granite.
This is a documentary, and I have to address the fact that as I'm talking about this, we just had actually two hikers die in Yosemite from going to the edge of a cliff. There's a lookout out there and there's no railings. That's kind of the point of it, is that it's a lookout and there are two hikers that have fallen to their deaths just this weekend. So this movie's about rock climbing. It's about mountain climbing and it's about scaling El Capitan without the aids of any sort of safety gear. So we have a real pragmatic thing happening in the world today, in America today, where two people died just being at the top of a mountain. So this stuff is dangerous. And this shouldn't, you know, it's awkward to talk about this movie where a guy's doing this great feat of bravery when people have died. And it does beg the question of how much is safety, should that be a concern of the parks? Because on one hand, you don't want people falling to their deaths. But on the other hand, you don't want railings just obstructing the view all throughout the national parks. The point is that when people go to these parks, they need to err on the side of caution. They need to know what they're doing. And you shouldn't be walking out too far. You should know the terrain and you could die. I remember my wife and I on our honeymoon, we were in Hawaii and we were on Volcanoes National Park. Now, I don't know what it's like now because that was over 20 years ago that we had our honeymoon, but I remember going up to Kilauea, and you can't get to Kilauea because it was, at the time at least, it was actively erupting, but it was a slow, steady eruption and it was going into the sea. You could drive up to where the lava stopped on the road and you could see in the distance, especially it was like dusk, so you could see the red glow of the lava and you could see the steam coming off the ocean. And you could walk out on the lava, the rocks that had, of course, from a previous eruption, and you could hike out there, but you're like a couple miles away. But we walked out onto the rocks. We didn't come anywhere close to where the actual lava was going on. But there's, you know, you can put up signs, but people are going to ignore things. And I think that this brings up a good issue in terms of Free Solo, is you if people want to do these things, you shouldn't stop them, even if you may die doing them. And Free Solo is an interesting movie because I showed it to my father, who's like in his 80s, and he had nothing. He's like, I would never do that because he's not a risk taker. But it shows a certain breed of person that will take these kind of risks. It reminds me a little bit of the movie Sunshine Superman that came out a couple years ago, and it was about daredevils. And it was about a guy who ended up dying doing these daredevil things, these base jumping stunts. And those people exist, and if they want to do it and that's how they live their lives, they should know. Now, if they sue because they said, oh, you let me scale El Capitan and I fell or whatever, well, you should know not to scale El Capitan. And if you do scale El Capitan, especially Free Solo, you should realize that you could very realistically fall to your deaths. And that's one of the things they point out in this documentary. They just don't, it's not just the chronicle of the guy climbing a mountain. It's about his life. It's about what brought him there. It's about other things he's done, how he's kind of a celebrity in the climbing world. It's about him having a girlfriend. And the girlfriend, it's funny because the girlfriend, she's very attractive and she seems very sweet, but it seems like she wants something out of him that he's not going to be able to deliver. She doesn't want him climbing. She doesn't want him doing the dangerous stuff. It's okay to climb. But they even make a point in the trailer and in the movie where they say anyone who's made free climbing a major part of their life has died. They eventually have a bad day. And that's the reality. If I have a bad day and I go to a screening and the movie's bad or the sound doesn't work right, or like when I saw Mission Impossible, the projection was terrible this summer, and that affected my movie. That's the worst thing that's going to happen. It's disappointing. You have a bad day as a mountain climber or a rock climber, and you slip and you don't do it perfectly, you could plummet 1,000 feet onto rocks and die. And that's that danger is really apparent in this documentary. Now, it's a really well done documentary, and it's got beautiful imagery, and it's harrowing to watch this on screen. But it's somewhat, you know, a standard documentary of somebody trying to do a feat. But I like this one better than, say, something like Man on Wire, which was the guy reflecting on him doing it. This is all leading up to it. So he's talking about, I'm getting ready to do this, I'm going to do this. Unless you know the story, you don't know whether he makes it or not. And that was my big problem with Man on Wire when that movie came out about 10 years ago. Well, the guy's doing an interview, and well, you know he didn't fall from the World Trade Center because He's giving an interview in the 2000s about this. So Free Solo is an interesting movie. It's absolutely worth seeing for the daredevil nature and the vistas and the composition of the film, and also to a look into what kind of a person does these sort of things and kind of what makes them tick. So I'm going to have to say that Free Solo rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next one I want to hit really quickly is The Fog. This is getting a limited re-release in theaters this week. And part of it's because it's John Carpenter. You know, it's been 38 years since this movie came out. So they're giving a re-release and you're getting some theatrical play in this. So I thought it was a good time to take a look back on John Carpenter's The Fog. This 1980s thriller is about dead sailors returning to their seaside village 100 years after they were betrayed. And it comes back to theaters this Halloween.
Stevie Wayne here.
And let me be the first to wish Antonio Bay a happy birthday. We're 100 years old today.
And keep a watch out for that fog bank heading in from the east.
100 years ago, between midnight and one, something unknown came out of the fog. Now it has returned.
Oh, Jesus.
100 years ago, between midnight and one, something unnatural came out of the fog. Now it has returned.
This is one of Carpenter's movies that he made in one of his best runs of his career. When you look at what he made from Halloween through, I'm going to say up till The Mouth of Madness, and I talked about that a couple weeks ago. That was a great run. Now there's some stinkers in there, and there are some movies that aren't as good, like Memoirs of an Invisible Man. I also talked about that relatively recently as a John Carpenter look back. That one's an okay movie. It doesn't quite hold up nowadays. But for the most part, I mean, you had Halloween, you had The Fog, you had The Thing, you had Big Trouble in Little China, you had They Live, you had Prince of Darkness, you had eventually, like I said, In the Mouth of Madness. He really loses steam in the 90s, but gosh, this was really starting his great run. I mean, this was a follow-up to Halloween, and you had a fantastic run yet to come, because 2 years later, he's going to be doing The Thing. The other thing that's neat about this is relatively early in his career, at least as a star director. And it has a great cast with like Adrian Barbeau and John Houseman and Janet Leigh. And of course, Tom Atkins is in it and Jamie Lee Curtis. And it's a creepy movie, but it's a slow burn for a Carpenter movie. It's not a high action thrill ride. It's only 90 minutes. But it takes its time to get through what it needs to do. And that's a great way to follow up Halloween, because Halloween relied a lot on suspense and, you know, has a lot of connective tissue with Psycho or something like that. So The Fog, also with the special effects, using The Fog looked really good, which was terrible when they remade it back in 2005 or something like that. So this is an indelible movie. And even though it's a slower burn and it takes its time and it has probably more characters than it needs to, It's a great little horror movie, and it's definitely worth checking out, especially if you're a fan of John Carpenter or any of the actors involved. So I'm going to have to say that The Fog totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Box Office and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Creepshow and Maximum Overdrive. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's look at the box office really quick, a little bit early in this segment. And of course, last week, the big hit of the weekend was Halloween. That's not a big surprise. That wasn't a big surprise. Everyone wasn't expecting it to do well. I was seeing predictions in the 60 millions, but it ended up winning the weekend with $76 million, which is a huge amount of money for a horror movie, let alone a movie that's a series that's 40 years old. Right now, it stands at number one as the highest grossing Halloween movie, even topping Halloween 2007, the awful Rob Zombie remake, which had an opening of like $26 million in theaters, which was considered spectacular then. And if you remember back, the original Halloween, I don't know what the opening of that one was, but it was pretty low. I mean, its final domestic total was like just under $50 million, and that's after being played for 40 years. So Halloween 2018 was a huge, huge, huge amount of money for a horror movie to make. And this is, of course, in a post-It, Conjuring, Paranormal Activity world. But there's a cautionary tale to all this. As much as it was cool to see Halloween win, and then, of course, you had, like, go down A Star is Born and Venom and Goosebumps 2, those all, you know, ratcheted down in terms of top 10. But Halloween's take was huge. Here's the problem, though. Do not expect every slasher movie, do not expect every Halloween movie to make $76 million its opening weekend. If you do that, you're a fool. And this is what can cause a series to fall apart. And this is what can cause box office to, if you chase that box office, it can be dangerous for you. And here's exactly what will happen. They'll make a Halloween 2, and it's not going to do as well. And then they'll do another one, and it also won't do as well as any other series will go, except for something like the superhero franchises where you build this complex universe with multiple characters over multiple movies. The danger of this is that they're going to expect every Halloween movie to at least make over $50 million, and then they're going to pull the plug as quickly as they can. That's what happened with the Friday the 13th. They rebooted that, and then they thought, oh, it dropped so fast in its second weekend. They said, well the franchise is dead, where you need to go back to, I've said this before, the Blumhouse model of making these movies for less than $10 million, and then when it makes $30 million, it's still a hit. The slasher craze in the 80s wasn't that these movies were making as much as the Star Wars movies were making. It's that they had a steady, consistent audience that always came to the movies and watched them. And that's what made those movies do so well. So that's a big caution with this one. And we're going into this weekend. Halloween's going to top again. It's going to make plenty of money. And it may drop very fast once we get outside of the Halloween frame. Once we're into November, it may drop. If we're leading into Thanksgiving, don't expect Halloween to still be making $20, $30 million a weekend. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Not a whole lot of big ones. I think Mamma Mia came out this week or something like that. That movie was terrible anyways. So let's talk about some of the steelbooks and the limited editions that came out, because it's the Halloween weekend and this is a great time to talk about some horror movies. The first one, which is coming out as a special edition, is Creepshow. Stephen King writes the screenplay for this anthology of horror stories based on the old EC horror comics.
From the author of Carrie, The Shining, and Cujo, and the creator of Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead, you'll scream at ghastly ghouls, cringe at weird kids, and shiver at the doings of evil doctors.
No, this is going to be an entirely new experience.
This came out in 1982 originally. I remember dying to see this movie because I was a huge fan of the EC horror comics. I was like in fifth grade. Huge fan of the EC horror comics. I was dying to see this movie because it just looked so fun and creepy and scary. And my mom took me to go see it. And I think she regretted it because I don't think she liked The Crate. But part of the thing with this movie is not only did it bring together George Romero and Stephen King, which it makes a great couple, but it also had a fantastic cast. You had Hal Holbrook and Adrian Barbeau and Fritz Weaver and E.G. Marshall. And Stephen King plays a goofy bumpkin in The Lonesome Death of Geordie Verrill. And, you know, you had Ted Danson was in it. You had an early role for Ed Harris in this movie. It's a fantastic cast. They've done anthology movies since, and they were anthology movies beforehand. But they've done other Creepshow movies, and those are terrible. Like, Creepshow 2 is sort of a half-hearted attempt. It was made in the late 80s. And then Creepshow 3, which came out in the 2000s, was just kind of awful in itself. These were five really good stories that were there. There were template stories. One's basically guy coming back from the grave. Another one, revenge from the grave. A monster in a box. You had bugs going after somebody. You had weeds from outer space. And each of these, a lot of them were based on original Stephen King stories that he sort of camped up for the show. And those were fun. And they made it very comic book-ish. You know, they had the panels and the frames. It's just a fun movie, and it really captures that essence of the comic books and fun horror movies without being you know, wink and the nod, trauma, making it essentially a comedy. There's very funny moments in this, but it's also pretty harrowing as well. So I really love this movie. I had a fantastic time watching it. I watch it all the time. It's out available on a new Blu-ray. Totally worth checking out. So yeah, I'm going to have to say Creepshow totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the next one I want to hit really quickly, and that is Maximum Overdrive. Stephen King takes a stab at directing this adaptation of his story, Trucks, about people trapped in a truck stop when machines become self-aware and animated.
My name is Stephen King. I've written several motion pictures, but I want to tell you about a movie called Maximum Overdrive, which is the first one I've directed.
What in the dickens is going on around here?
A lot of people have directed Stephen King novels and stories. And I finally decided if you want something done right, you ought to do it yourself.
Who was driving it?
I don't know.
Now, if you remember earlier in the box office roundup in this segment, I was talking about the danger of expecting movies to make too much money. One of the interesting things that happened in the 80s is while you had big Stephen King movies like Carrie and The Shining, these were big Stephen King movies, but you also had a whole bunch of really small ones. Dino De Laurentiis bought up a bunch of the rights, and he made these small, crappy movies that had a very small budget, but they helped make Stephen King a household name, because while you had the big ones, you also had middling ones like Cujo, but you also had stuff like Cat's Eye and Creepshow or Maximum Overdrive. These were movies that may not have even been good, but it got Stephen King's name in the trailers and in the theaters so much that he became a household name just outside of books. And Maximum Overdrive was his chance to do his own film. And it's funny because I was watching it a couple years ago and I put on Twitter, I said, I'm watching this movie. It's directed by Stephen King. Somebody wrote back and said, dude, cocaine directed that movie. And in a lot of ways, that's true. Stephen King was on drugs when he made this movie. He will admit it. He's cleaned up since. But yeah, he was on drugs. This was the 80s. He was at the height of his career. You give a lot of money to somebody who has an addictive personality, you're going to get that. Maximum Overdrive is an absolute disaster of a film. It is a terrible movie. Stephen King has no idea what he's doing. He doesn't know how to direct. You can see him having fun, but not really knowing what to do. It's sort of like if you give somebody a basketball but not explain the rules and just tell them to shoot the basket, and they have to kind of even figure out that the ball has to go in the basket. And that's kind of the way it is watching this movie. It's not well made. It's not well plotted. It's not well written. And that the opening, I remember watching this trailer in the theaters thinking this looks so cool. He's like, I'm going to scare you. He's like pointing at the screen and he's doing his whole thing. But now it just looks absurd because it was such a bad movie and it didn't do well. But it's also a gloriously bad movie. It's fun to make fun of. And there's also some amazing stuff in there. There's a music element to this movie. AC/DC did the soundtrack to this, which is amazing. Now, some of them are existing songs, but you know, Stephen King's a huge rock and roll fan and he had a relationship with AC/DC, and yeah, they got that's the music, and it's kind of amazing because the movie's so crappy and small, yet one of the biggest rock bands in history did the music. Other interesting musical notes is if you listen to that trailer, the music for that comes from Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, another one of my favorite ironic, silly movies from the 80s. That's fantastic because it all actually works better in Maximum Overdrive than it does in the Halloween franchise. So there's some gems in this, not Emilio Estevez and his terrible acting, and some of the lines and moments in this movie are just goofy as all get out. But boy, if Maximum Overdrive isn't fun to watch, maybe if, you know, I'm not saying to get in the state of mind Stephen King was when he was directing this, because somebody may lose an eye like the cinematographer did in the film, but it might be fun with a few adult beverages and some junk food. That's just the kind of movie to watch, especially if you kind of have that nostalgia from the 80s. It's such a bizarre movie to look at in retrospect. So I'm going to have to say that Maximum Overdrive still isn't a great movie, but I'm going to have to say it kind of rocks just for the fun 80s aspect of it.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this week. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about the Nutcracker and the Four Realms. And until then, have a happy Halloween and a fat time at the movies.